In 1981, I spent 3 months in Tuscany, Italy. And specifically, it was from September through to November. And I spent those 3 months in a convent, or what used to be a convent. It was no longer a convent. It was now, somebody called Adam had bought the place. He was a friend of Vajracetu. So some of you know Vajracetu. They were very good friends before Vajracetu got involved with our movement. And so he kept up contact with him, and Sangharakshita Bhante had been wanted to start ordination training courses lasting about 3 months and away from everything, somewhere else. So Vajracetu told Sangharakshita about this place, and we ended up using it for the first few of our men's ordination training retreats. And I was at the first one in 1981. And Bhante Sangharakshita was leading it, and there were four order members supporting him, and there were, I think, 18, something like that, men who were training to be ordained. And there we were, a very old ramshackle building with cloisters. It had cloisters, but Adam didn't have the money to do it up. The reason Adam had bought that place, he was a lover of opera, especially early opera, and he, every summer he'd put on a series of operas there, and people would come from all over and listen to these operas. But he wasn't doing very much with it in the autumn, so he rented it out to us over a few years. And I'm telling you this because there we were on a lovely hill, this place. And there was another hill, there was a valley, and then there was another hill, and there was a little town, village there called Batignano, and everywhere else was just countryside. And the sun was shining a lot, especially September, October, very warm, very hot at times. And we had some really dramatic thunderstorms, the kind of thunderstorms you get in films, you know, where the windows rattle, and really very dramatic. And it was a very lovely, beautiful time. And Sangharakshita very much led the retreat. He was very present. He was doing lots of teaching, lots of question and answers with us, meeting us in small groups of five, leading study. And on that retreat, he started talking about something that he'd been thinking about for some time, which was faith. And especially he'd been thinking about faith as depicted, as expressed, as explored in Mahayana sutras. And he'd come to the conclusion that faith in Mahayana was imagination. That's a very interesting combination of things there, isn't there? That faith in Mahayana sutras is basically imagination. And therefore the awakening of faith is the awakening of the imagination. And he went on to say, he kind of defined what the imagination was. He said he distinguished it from fantasy or fancy. You know, we all fantasize, don't we? We think about the time when we retire. I'm doing that at the moment, fantasizing about the time when I retire and I'll be able to do what I want. And instead of having to work for a living, there are sexual fantasies, there are fantasies about having a holiday somewhere, fantasies about going out with someone that you fancy. That's not the imagination as Bhante was talking about. And he distinguished the imagination from that kind of imagination by calling what he was talking about the imagination with a capital I, a capital I. And he also used the word the imaginal, which is a lovely, I love that term, the imaginal, and the imaginal faculty. And he said that what he was talking about was really the imagination is reason and emotion combined together, but on a higher level. Yeah. So we all know the distinction between head and heart, don't we? And we all know sometimes that they're not in agreement with each other. We all know how sometimes we know the rational thing, the reasonable thing, the best thing to do would be to do this, but we do that instead, because our emotions take us away to that. So often our reason and emotion are at odds with each other, they don't really meet, but part of the process of living the spiritual life, part of the process of integration is to marry those two together, emotion and reason. But there's the marrying of the two, there's the integration of the two, which is one thing, but the imagination is more than that. It's those two integrated but on a higher level, if you can imagine that. That's what faith is, that's what the imagination is. And he went on to say that the imaginal faculty, as he began to call it, was the faculty that perceives the way the things the way they are. The imaginal faculty is the state of mind which sees reality. So that's what he was talking about. And as I say, he was talking specifically about faith in Mahayana Sutras. And when you, I don't know if you've read Mahayana Sutras or if you had much contact with them, but they are often highly imaginative. And the Mahayana, they imagine the universe. Well, we all imagine the universe. We imagine a lot. Neuroscience tells us this, doesn't it? That a lot of what we think we see, we perceive, we hear and so on, is largely imagined. I like to often pose the question, what kind of world do you imagine yourself to be in? That's a nice question, isn't it? What kind of world do you imagine yourself to be in? Because it is largely imagined. The world that you live in is largely imagined. And just imagine this. Imagine that if your whole conception of the spiritual life was not quite right, or even completely wrong. Just imagine if you conceived of the spiritual life as being one of getting... practicing so that you could gain insight. Yeah. And insight for you would be seeing things as they are. Yeah. Getting clarity. But imagine if that was quite wrong. Just imagine that. That's a complete misconception. Not complete, but fairly misconceived idea of what the spiritual life is. What if the spiritual life wasn't about becoming clear with insight and understanding things better? What if it wasn't that? What if the spiritual life was one of imagining the world you're in better? Imagining the world that you live in more vividly. What if the spiritual life was one of imagining life more vividly, better? And that great turning that we're moving towards, we hope we're moving towards anyway, we're supposed to be moving towards if we're Buddhists. The point of irreversibility, the point of no return, the point where we often think of as being, you understand the Dharma so well that you cannot fall back from the path, you cannot fall back from awakening, from enlightenment. Now, that moment, or perhaps series of moments, but that great turning in early Buddhism is called stream entry. In Mahayana Buddhism is called either the awakening of the bodhicitta, the arising of the bodhicitta, or irreversibility from Advaitika, irreversibility from complete awakening. We often conceive of that great turning in cognitive terms, I think. We think that when we've got to that point of irreversibility, what's happened is that now we really understand the Dharma. Imagine if I said to you, this morning I had an insight. You'd probably think, oh, I wonder what he understood better. Was it that he understood that things really were impermanent? He really understood that in a way that he'd never understood before. Or maybe you think that I've understood that there really is no enduring self. I've got that at last. It's become clear to me. We think in those terms, don't we, often? I think Western Buddhists, not only of our school of Buddhism, but many other schools, think of the spiritual life in those terms. It's one of becoming clear, understanding, knowing better, yeah? But what if it wasn't that? What if we've misunderstood the whole thing? What if that point of no return was where you really imagined much better than you were imagining before? What if that was the point of irreversibility? I think that's what the Pure Land Sutras are saying. It's very interesting reading the Pure Land Sutras because they're so unlike the kind of Buddhism that we in the West have taken to our hearts, which is the fairly intellectual kind of Buddhism, which is all about ideas. I remember having a girlfriend whose mother was Christian, and she came along to the Buddhist Center one day, and she was looking in the bookshop, and after 10, 15 minutes looking around, she said, "Oh, it's all so intellectual, isn't it, Buddhism?" And I understood what she meant. There's so many ideas and so on, and we think of ourselves as becoming wise is becoming knowing better, understanding better. But the Pure Land Sutras don't really go in for that kind of thing. There's two of them do mention no self and impermanence once or twice in their hundreds of pages. It's just mentioned the rivers in the longer Sukhavativiya Sutra, the rivers, great long rivers, 10 miles wide, 90 miles wide, going down, flowers in the rivers. And they murmur, impermanence, no self, peace. And that's it. That's all of the conceptual teachings you're going to get in the 90 pages of that sutra. And if you've missed it, you've missed it. Yeah, it's gone down with the river and it's gone. So you get tiny little bits of conceptual teaching there, but they're not really interested in that. I would say that the Pure Land Sutras are not interested in knowledge. Interesting enough, they're not even interested in the self and getting over the self. You know, understanding that there is no self. They just don't bother themselves with it. What they're really interested in is awakening your imagination. So I thought what I'd do this evening is I'll introduce you to what I think of as the third of the Pure Land Sutras. There isn't really a 1, 2, and 3, actually. There are just 3 sutras. But in the book that I've just written, it comes third. It's chapters 7 and 8 of the book are concerned with this particular sutra. And they're all rather different from each other, but this one is quite different from the other two. And the other two, both called the Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, and there's a short one, 6 pages, and there's a long one, 70-odd pages. And so one's called the shorter Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, and the other's called the longer. But they probably, as far as we know, were probably written, composed in what was then India but is now Pakistan. And this is a nice little coincidence. Do you know what the word Pakistan means? Anybody? Pure land. Yeah, it means pure land. Well, wonderful coincidence. So Pakistan, about 1-200 years common era. But this one, the one I'm going to talk about this evening, which is called the Sutra on the Visualization of the Buddha Amitayus, was probably written in China about 400-500 years common era. It says it's a translation from the Sanskrit, but it's probably lying to us because the Sanskrit has never been found anywhere. Yeah, so it's probably what's called a Wei Jing. Jing means treatise or sutra, and Wei is pseudo. And there were many of them written in China. They used to write sutras, and they used to pass them off for being coming from India, because India had a lot of kudos. That was where the Buddha was from. So, and as the Buddha is supposed to have spoken all sutras, therefore it must have come from India, and therefore they had to pretend that it was a translation from the Indian, from the Sanskrit. It could have originated somewhere in India, but probably it was written down in China. I won't attempt to give you the Chinese title. It's too much for me. But as I say, the English, we in our movement, we know it as the Amitāya Jñāna Sutra. But Amitāya Jñāna is Sanskrit. So that's a Sanskritization of Chinese terms. And Ratnagosha said, "I know it is the contemplation or the visualization sutra," and that is a translation of the. It's been abbreviated from its very long title to a short title, which is Guanjing. Now, what does that remind you of, Guanjing? Guanyin, yeah? So, same word. The first word is the same. I don't know what yin means. Anybody know what yin means in Guanyin? We're an ignorant bunch, aren't we? But jing, as I said, means sutra. And guan, or quan, means to look. It means to look. But it also means, by extension, to visualize. Yeah? And it also means, according to Shvedapa, the translator, it has connotations of insight. Now, there's a nice three words to put together in one, isn't it? To look, to visualize, or we could say to imagine, and to have insight. So you've got those two ideas together there, haven't you? Imagination and insight together in the one word, guan. So the guan jing, the visualization or the contemplation, sometimes called the meditation sutra. And it begins like this. This is what I have heard. Once the Buddha was staying in Rajagriha on Vulture's Peak with a great sangha of 1,250 monks. There were also 32,000 bodhisattvas there who were led by Manjushri, the youthful prince of the Dharma. That's an awful lot of people to fit on Vulture's Peak, isn't it? 1,250 monks and 32,000 bodhisattvas. One of the great things about these sutras is as soon as you start reading them, you're in another world. And here, we're in a partly historical world and a partly imagined world. Yeah. Well, both are imagined, actually. When we imagine historical worlds, we're imagining them. So we're imagining what we think of is historical, real, we probably think, but we're also imagining an imagined world, yeah? There were times in the Pali Canon when it said that the Buddha was sitting around with 1,250 monks. So that, we could say, is India, probably historically more or less accurate, though I'm sure nobody ever took the trouble to count all those beings there, but about 1,000 and so people. But with the 32,000 bodhisattvas, we enter into the imagination, the world of the imaginal. So now you have to imagine Vulture's Peak in India, the Buddha sitting there with all his monks, plus 32,000 bodhisattvas. You have to try to imagine that. And then immediately the scene shifts to nearby Rajagriha, the city of Rajagriha, and specifically the palace of King Bimbisara. Or we should say the ex-King Bimbisara, because he's just been kidnapped and put into prison by his son, Prince Ajatasatru. And he's been put into the seventh floor of the prison and shut away. And what's happening is Ajatasatru is starving his father to death in that dungeon. He's not allowed food or drink. And he'll die, he hopes, quite soon, and then he'll become the king. That's what's happening. So we've moved from one world, ancient India, 2,500 years ago, Vulture's Peak, partly real, partly imagined. Suddenly we moved into another world, a horrible world. The royal palace with its dungeons and horrible intrigue and terrible things happening. Bimbisara is going to die. Bimbisara is a lovely man. You get him a fair few times in the Pali Canon. A great friend of the Buddha, devoted to the Buddha. Lovely king, lovely man, lovely Buddhist. His queen was Vaidehi, and she was devoted to her husband. And Ajatasatru allowed her to see Bimbisara every day. She could go and visit him every day. And what she did, she covered her body with flour and honey and ghee. And in her jewelry, she put grape juice. And she'd go to visit him, and he would take his fill. Everyone laughs at this, because you can imagine, well, how did he get that? Well, he must have licked her all over. Let's get it out in the open. He must have licked her all over and taken the grape juice from her earrings or whatever. And that kept him alive for months. And the king would bow down to Vulture's Peak where the Buddha was every day, and he would ask the Buddha to send Mahamudgalyayana to go and visit him and give him the 8 precepts. Now, the 8 precepts are the 5 precepts plus 3 extra ones that you take on festival days, full moon days. They're special precepts for lay followers. So he would take that from Mahamudgalyayana. And Purna, who was a great teacher, would come and teach him in the dungeon. They weren't allowed in the dungeon, so they did it all by magic. So again, we're in this horrible situation. This really did happen. Bimbisara really did imprison his father and starve him to death. That's historical fact, apparently. But we're partly in history and we're partly in the imaginal, because you have to imagine now these monks kind of flying through the air and going through walls and ending up as kind of apparitions in his cell and teaching him. One of the things I say about these sutras is they don't tell the truth. Yeah, that's not what they're doing. I can't quite remember how Picasso put it, but Picasso once said that art doesn't tell the truth. It tells stories, and through those stories you see the truth. So the texts aren't telling us the truth. They're trying to awaken our imagination. So this is what you have to imagine. But then, after a few months, Ajatasattu went to see the dungeon keeper and said, "Is the king still alive?" "Yeah, he's still alive." He said, "Well, how can that be?" And the dungeon keeper told Ajatasattu about Vaidehi's visits, what's been happening. He got furious, absolutely furious. And he called Vaidehi into the palace and drew his sword, and he was going to kill her with his sword. But 2 ministers stood up and got in front of him and said, "No, you can't do that. In the last aeon, 18,000 princes have killed their father, the king, for the kingdom. But we've never heard of a prince killing his mother. That's just beyond the pale. You can't do it." Yeah. Isn't that funny? How it seems to be okay to kill your father, but it's not okay to kill your mother. Must be a reason for it. Anyway, they persuade the king, Prince Ajatasattu, not to kill his mother, but instead he locks her in another dungeon. So now they've had it. Yeah. This is the pits of despair, because for Vaidehi, because she can no longer help her husband. She can no longer keep him alive. So she's sitting in a dungeon now. She's in despair, and the text said her tears fell like rain. And she called on the Buddha. And she asked him to send 2 monks to her to teach her the Dharma. And he did. He sent, Mahamudgalyayana and Ananda. That's it, those two. He sent them. But he came along with them. They magicked themselves into her cell. And I'm going to read you a bit of the text now. When Vaidehi raised her head, because she was on the floor, right, crying in utter despair. When Vaidehi raised her head, she saw the Blessed One, the Buddha Shakyamuni. His body was the colour of gold, and he was seated on a lotus flower made of 100 different kinds of precious substances. Mudgalyayana stood to his left and Ananda to his right. Chakra, Brahma, the protectors of the world, and all the other gods surrounded him in the air, showering him with heavenly flowers. So you have to imagine this in her cell. This is happening. There's the Buddha there. Gold. Shining gold. There's Mahamudgalyayana and Ananda on either side of him. There are gods showering flowers on them. And from there, Vaidehi starts speaking to the Buddha. They have a dialogue. And as a result of that dialogue, the Buddha teaches Vaidehi. And this whole story takes about 4 pages. And then there are 18 pages of the Buddha's teaching. And first of all, the Buddha teaches Friday, he about ethics. He talks about the three great meritorious acts, and each of those meritorious acts is broken into three or four. So it's about 10 meritorious acts altogether, including the 10 precepts which order members take. So that's the ethical part of the teaching. And then the rest of the teaching is 16 visualizations, and that takes up 18 pages. But why does he do that? He does that because Vaidehi says to him, "Blessed one, it is my heartfelt desire that you would reveal to me a place free of sorrow, free of the defilements. In my future lives, I do not wish to try to find happiness in this world of confusion and evil." She goes on like that for a bit, and then she says, "I now prostrate myself to you, Blessed One. I repent and ask you to take pity on me. My only heartfelt desire is that the Buddha, who is like the sun, might teach me how to visualize a place where the effects of all actions have been purified." Notice how she wants to go to a place, yeah? Somewhere other than this place. This place is horrible for her, for obvious reasons. So that's what she asks. The Buddha, I don't know how much of this text you want to hear. Is this interesting you to hear the text like this? Shall I read you the next bit? "The Buddha then sent forth a ray of golden light from between his eyebrows, which illuminated innumerable world systems in the 10 directions of space." One of the things I say throughout my book is that what you don't do with this text is ask whether something's true, yeah, because it's not in the way that we think of it. That's not the question to ask. The question we should ask ourselves as we're listening to the text is, of what benefit might it be for me to imagine this? That's the question, yeah. Of what benefit might it be for me to imagine what the Buddha's saying, yeah. So imagine this. "The light then returned to the Buddha and gathered at the top of his head, where it was transformed into a golden platform which resembled Mount Sumeru. All of the wondrous pure Buddha fields in the 10 directions of space appeared there. Some were made of the 7 kinds of precious substances. Some of nothing but lotus flowers. Some resembled the heavens of the gods who enjoy pleasures created by others. And some were like crystal mirrors in which all the other Buddha fields in the 10 directions of space appeared. In this way, Vaidehi was able to see an infinite number of Buddha fields in all their majesty." Should say something about Buddha fields, haven't said anything about that yet. But the Mahayana, those Mahayana Buddhists, they imagined the universe. I was just talking about that a while back, wasn't I? And I got sidetracked and talked about the fact that we imagine our universe. But the universe that we imagine is very much conditioned by science. Yeah, we've been told what the universe really looks like and really is from scientists. The Mahayana Buddhists didn't, of ancient India and China, didn't have this. They imagined the universe in a very different way. And the universe they imagined was one which was shot through with spirituality and transcendence. And that was expressed by the fact that there were Buddhas everywhere. All over the universe, multitudes, millions, trillions of them, all over the place. And each one has their own Buddha field, which Buddha field is like an area. It's like an electric field. It's like a massive, great area, something like a galaxy. And there are trillions of them, and different kinds of Buddha fields. We live in a Buddha field. Our Buddha field is an impure Buddha field. An impure Buddha field is one characterized by sorrow and pain and confusion. But a pure Buddha field is characterized by beauty and happiness. So what the Buddha's doing here, he's revealing to Vaidehi Buddha fields all over the universe. That's what he's doing. So she's seeing this Guan. She's imagining, she's seeing with her mind's eye the beauty, the transcendence of the universe, the kind of Buddha essence, the Dharma essence, which is all over the universe. Yeah, there's nowhere where the Dharma isn't. She says, "Blessed one, although all of these Buddha fields are pure and radiant, I wish to be born in Sukhavati, where the Buddha Amitabha dwells. My only heartfelt desire, blessed one, is that you would teach me how to contemplate that Buddha field and attain meditative concentration by doing so." I haven't mentioned this word, I haven't highlighted this word heartfelt desire yet, so I want to now. She's mentioned that three times. She has a heartfelt desire. This is a Chinese text, but the Sanskritization of, if we were to translate into Chinese, into Sanskrit, it would be pranidhana. And pranidhana is often, is the word used for the bodhisattva vow. So it's a very strong word, the bodhisattva vow. And it's that word, pranidhana, that Shraddhapa translates as heartfelt desire. So she's got this heartfelt desire for obvious reasons. But what I want to say now is that up until now she's been talking about a place. She wants to go to another place. She wants to be reborn somewhere else. And the Buddha has been going along with that, showing her places, yeah, Buddha fields. But now she changes the language. And she says, "I wish to be born in Sukhavati," still talking about a place. But then she says, "My only heartfelt desire is that you would teach me how to contemplate Guan, yeah, that Buddha field, and attain meditative concentration by doing so." She's changed the terms of what she wants from being born in a place to meditative concentration. And in Buddhism, as I'm sure you know, places and states of mind are interrelated. In my book, I quote a French poet whose name I can't quite remember anymore. It's a long time ago when I wrote the book. Can't remember his name. You'll have heard of him, Rombo or someone like that. And he said something like, you might remember better than me because you've read the book more recently. Every landscape is a mind, or something like that. So mind and landscape are very much connected. And you know that, don't you, from your own experience, that depending on the state of mind you're in, the landscape can look quite different. So minds and places in Buddhism are not two separate things. Yeah, a state of mind is a world in Buddhism. When you enter a new state of mind, you enter a new world in a way. I was in Sao Paulo last year, just name dropping here, Sao Paulo, and it was at a mindfulness conference, and there was this Brazilian scientist, very bright man, and he gave this presentation, which unfortunately I missed. I only got there for the question and answers afterwards. But afterwards, I started talking to him, and he was really waxing eloquent about the imagination. He's a neuroscientist, and he was talking about the fact that the world we perceive is largely imagined. He was talking in those kind of terms. And I said, "Well, that's really interesting. I've just written this book, mainly about the imagination." He said, "Oh, tell me more." And I told him about Pure Land. She said, "What's a Pure Land?" And I told him about it and how these ancient Buddhists used to visualize this kind of imagined land. And he said, "If one person visualizes a Pure Land, it's in their imagination. If two people visualize it, they created a world." That's amazing, isn't it? So we create the world. And together, we can create a new world. But let's get back to the text. Where should we go from here? How are we doing for time? I've got no idea how long I've been going on for.
Carry on.
Pardon?
Carry on.
Okay. Let's move on. Now, where should we go from here? Yes. Then, actually, you might be a bit worried about Bimbisara. We're talking about, you might be thinking, what's going to happen to him? Well, after this, what happens is, so that just after what Vaidehi said to the Buddha, the Blessed One then smiled. Rays of light of five different colours came from his mouth, and each shone on the head of King Bimbisara, who's in another cell somewhere else. So these rays of light went from the Buddha's mouth onto the head of King Bimbisara. Although the great king was imprisoned, he could see the Blessed One from afar in his mind's eye, without hindrance. He bowed down to the Blessed One in reverence and attained the state of a non-returner in a spontaneous and natural way. State of a non-returner, the stage of irreversibility. He was just sitting in his cell, thinking about the Buddha. The Buddha, the rays of light, the five rays of light, went onto the king's head, and spontaneously and naturally, he became irreversible from awakening. Yeah, that's what happened. Then, the Buddha said this to Vaidehi, "You do not know it yet, but the Buddha, Amitabha, is not far away." Now, this is a very interesting statement, because actually he is a very, very long way, an unimaginably long way away, because he lives in Sukhavati, which is millions and trillions, untold millions and trillions, of galaxies away in the West. World systems away in the West. It's a very, very long way away. Yeah. But now he's saying he's not far away. So this is lovely, isn't it? Because distance, that's just imagine the distance. It's a very, very long way away. So far away that you can't imagine it. But actually, he's very close. Yeah. So the Buddha Amitabha is now very close. And what happens then is that the Buddha says something about Vaidehi, which is quite interesting, and I think important. I have to try and find it now. I was looking for it on the train on the way up, and I found it. And now I can't find it. You'll have to take my word for it. Here it is. He says to her, "You are an ordinary person with a weak and feeble mind. You do not have the power of divine vision, and so you cannot see things which are far away." Luckily for her, all Buddhas, Tathagatas have a range of skillful means at their disposal, which they can use to enable you to see. So now, they're working together. The Buddha and Vaidehi are working together. You've got what we in our movement call a superpersonal force. The Buddha's is now a superpersonal force working on Vaidehi. Listen closely. Listen closely and reflect carefully on what I am about to tell you. He's just about to teach her about the Pure Land. He's just about to give her 16 visualizations of the Pure Land. And from here on, what I say in my book is that the text is now a meditation manual, a visualization manual, because the other ones, the Sukhavati Vyuha Sutras, they just describe Sukhavati. But this one purports to do it in a very systematic way. Yeah, and you've got these 16 visualizations, and they, apart from the first one, they are incredibly complex and elaborate in a way that when I read it, I think, I can't possibly do that. It's far too complex and elaborate. And Luis Gomez, who's written a wonderful book called The Land of Bliss, which is a translation and commentary on the two Sukhavati Vyuha Sutras. Towards the end of that book, he just mentions this other sutra, and he says, although it purports to be like a meditation manual, He says he thinks it's more of a liturgy, something just to be listened to or read through. Yeah. And the images come thick and fast, and they are, as I say, very elaborate, psychedelic almost. They really come at you. And 16 of these visualizations, the first six are visualizations of the Pure Land in great detail. And then you've got another few, which are visualizations of Amitayus. So I'm going to jump onto those two now, jump through. So he's just finished the sixth visualization, teaching Vaidehi the sixth visualization. And he's just about to start teaching her how to visualize the Buddha, Amitayus. But before he does that, something happens. He says, as he spoke these words, the Buddha Amitayus appeared in the air above him, above the Buddha, with the two great beings, Avalokiteshvara and Mahasthamaprapta, on either side of him. They were blazing with light so brilliant that it was impossible to see them properly. Even the radiance of gold from the Jambu River multiplied 100,000 times could not compare with it. What does that vision remind you of? Isn't it rather like the vision that Vaidehi had in the dungeon when the Buddha and his two disciples came with the gold and so on? And here, the Buddha, they're still in that form now, yeah? So the Buddha's teaching Vaidehi and is still gold with flowers showering down on him and his two disciples on either side, right? But now above him comes a vision very similar, but it's Amitabha and his two chief disciples, Avalokiteshvara and Mahasthamaprapta. So you've got this vision with a vision above them, yeah? So Vaidehi sees this spontaneously. And then she says, this is amazing, but what about all these other beings? How can they get to see this like this? How can they attain this vision themselves? So the Buddha tells her. And Ananda's there, and we know that Ananda remembers everything, and the Buddha knows that. So he's teaching Vaidehi and Ananda for the good of mankind. And here we are now, in mythic terms, benefiting from that. The Buddha says to Vaidehi, those who wish to visualize this Buddha should gather their attention and focus their minds on a lotus flower made of seven kinds of precious substances growing from the earth. And then he starts really building this lotus up in a way that is incredible. But then he says, when you have attained a vision of these things, which is all the things he's taught us so far, you should then focus your mind on the Buddha. Why should you do this? The body of all the Buddhas, all Tathagatas, is the totality of phenomena. This is Chinese Fajie. Last week, 2 weeks ago, I was in West London and I said this, Fajie. And there was a Chinese woman, young Chinese woman in the audience. I said, oh, do you speak Chinese? She said, yeah. And I said, am I pronouncing it? She said, no. And I got her to say it a few times, but I can't remember now exactly how she did it. But anyway, it's the Chinese version of the word that we know as Dharma Dhatu. Yeah, the realm of reality. The wisdom of the Dharma Dhatu is the wisdom that knows that everything is real. Yeah, there is no illusions anywhere. Everything is real. The problem with is us, the way we see things. Yeah, we're deluded. There's no illusion out there. Everything is just as it is, and we're deluded. Everything is real. Yeah. So, the body of all the Buddhas, all the Tathagatas, is the totality of phenomena, or the realm of reality. And they, the Buddhas, enter into the focused minds of all living beings. That is, if they want them to. So us, Buddhists, if we want, we can allow the Buddhas, who are reality, to enter into our minds. Therefore, when your mind creates the Buddha, and when you imagine the Buddha, when your mind creates the Buddha, your mind becomes the Buddha. Yeah? That's important, isn't it? When you create the Buddha in your mind becomes the Buddha. That's why we visualize the Buddha. That's why we bowed down to him. The ocean of all the perfectly awakened Buddhas arises from the focused mind. Therefore, you should concentrate your attention with an integrated mind and visualize the Buddha, the Tathagata, the Arhat, the perfectly awakened Buddha with great care. When you can see the image of the Buddha sitting there, your mind's eye will open and you will be able to see him completely. Yeah? Your mind's eye will open and you will be able to see him completely clearly. You will also see the adornments of Sukhavati, which are made of the seven kinds of precious substances. The ground made of precious substances. I should tell you what the precious substances are, shouldn't I? Gold, depends on the sutra, but more or less this is what they are. Gold, silver, lapis lazuli, quartz, sapphire, ruby, and emerald. That's what the Pure Land is made of. The ground made of precious substances, the ponds made of precious substances, the rows of trees made of precious substances, the heavenly cloth made of precious substances draped over the trees, and the abundant nets made of precious substances which fill the sky. Visualize all this completely clearly so that you can see it as distinctly as if you were looking at something in the palm of your hand. Yeah. Now, what I particularly want to draw your attention to is the Buddha is reality. When you create the Buddha in your mind, the Buddha enters into your mind, so reality enters into your mind. What he's talking about is the awakening of insight. Yeah. He doesn't use those terms. He's using imaginative terms. Yeah. Insight is the Buddha entering your mind. Yeah, that's what it really is. So now, Vaidehi now has deep insight into the Dharma. And because of that insight, her mind eye has opened. Yeah, and because her mind's eye has opened, she is now able to see the whole of Sukhavati spontaneously. She doesn't need to anymore. And it's very interesting that in early Buddhism, the classic way to gain what we call insight, that the point of irreversibility, is, first of all, ethics, then concentration, absorption, meditation, absorbing your mind so that you become integrated and so that you enter into jhana, which is, the first jhana is the coming together of reason and emotion together. You know that lovely image that the Buddha used of soap, powder and water coming together. That's the integration of reason and emotion. And then you enter into second jhana and third jhana. And what are these jhanas? They are imaginative states of mind. Yeah. You enter into those jhanas. And from there, from jhana, with that imaginative state of mind, you then gain insight. Yeah. That's the classic way of doing it. The interesting thing about this is the Buddha and the other Arahants can enter into any jhana they want to at any moment they want to. They can just come and go at will in the jhanas. So what that means is there's a great connection between jhana, this highly imaginative state, and wisdom. Yeah, you need to get into this highly imaginative state to gain wisdom. Imagination is the faculty that perceives reality, yeah? And when you've gained wisdom, you're in, or you can get into that highly imaginative state very, very easily. So, the point of all this text, this 70 odd pages of text, is to open our mind's eye, to awaken our imagination. Not so that we can see things as they really are, although you could put it in those terms if you want to, but so that you can imagine the world that you're living in much better. And I should finish, I'm guessing, I don't really know what time I'm supposed to finish, but I'm going to finish now by telling you what happens at the end of all this. It's So after these 16 very fulsome, highly imaginative visualizations, whilst the Buddha was speaking these words, Vaidehi and her 500 ladies-in-waiting listened to what he was saying. They were immediately able to see Sukhavati with all of its many different features, and they attained a vision of the body of the Buddha. Remember, the body of the Buddha is the realm of reality, and the two bodhisattvas. Vaidehi exclaimed, I have never experienced anything like this before. Her mind became clear, and she attained great realization, and patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are unarisen. Now this is patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are unarisen is the English from the Sanskrit. I don't know what the Chinese, but the Sanskrit is anutpatika dharma kshanti. Kshanti is usually is patience. But there was, and so we often, the way we often think of this great, I'll tell you what it is first. So this state is when you not only understand that all things are impermanent, but you see that there are no things to be impermanent. Things are so radically impermanent, there's no thing that you could point to that is impermanent. Everything is just flow. Yeah, everything is a state of flow. And this is, when you really understand this, you become an irreversible bodhisattva. Now, anutpatika dharma kshanti. Kshanti is patience. And so it's often translated as the patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are ultimately unarisen. Unarisen because there's no phenomena to arise. And this is a scary thing, you know, so you need to have patience with it. But actually there are some scholars, some translators who think that the word has been Sanskritized wrongly. And it doesn't come from the root kshanti, it comes from the root kham, K-H-A-M, which means willing, which is a very different thing, isn't it? So if you think of it like that, this is the willing. This is the joyful acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are ultimately unarisen. Anyway, it's a high, very exalted state of mind that Vaidehi has ended up in as a result of this teaching of the Buddha. And remember, the Buddha was at pains to tell her, right at the beginning, that she was an ordinary person with a weak and feeble mind. But here she is, she's come out as this amazing, wise, highly imaginative being. And that's the end, really. It ends like that, but I just want to say one more thing, because right at the end, the Buddha says this, you should understand that those who recollect the Buddha are like the white lotus flowers of humanity. Now, this idea stuck with Pure Land practitioners. They really like this idea of becoming white lotus flowers of humanity. And they began, you know, you get, in early Buddhism, you get the idea of the Arahant, the fully enlightened being who gained enlightenment under the tutelage of the Buddha. But then in the Mahayana, you get the Bodhisattva, someone who's practicing for innumerable lifetimes to become full Buddhas. But then in Pure Land Buddhism, you get the idea of the white lotus flower of humanity. And in Japan, you get what are called myokonin. A myokonin is a white, it's the Japanese translation of white lotus flower of humanity. And the myokonin are beings, very simple people, who don't believe that it's possible for them themselves to become bodhisattvas. That's far too exalted an ideal, far too heroic. No, we are just ordinary people. Yeah, we're just ordinary. We can't aspire to become bodhisattvas. We are the recipients of the bodhisattva's wisdom and compassion. We cannot become bodhisattvas. We are simply white lotus flowers of humanity. We're simply myokonin. Yeah. And in Japanese Pure Land literature, you get stories of these people. They're usually very simple folk. You know, they might be fishermen, housewives or whatever. But the way they live their lives is extraordinary. Yeah. It's what I call radical humility. where they're not thinking of themselves as being anything great. They're just going about their daily business, being ordinary people, they think, but actually through that ordinariness becoming quite extraordinary. So, I'm going to finish there. I'm sure it's time I finished. And I hope from this evening, your imagination has been awakened a little bit. Maybe your mind's eye has opened. And you maybe get a different understanding from what I've said about the Pure Land Sutras, about what the spiritual life is really about. Maybe it's different from what we thought. And in China and Japan, Pure Land Buddhism is incredibly popular. There are more Pure Land Buddhists in the world than any other denomination of Buddhist. And we in the West have more or less ignored them. Yeah? What do we know about Pure Land Buddhism? How many books about Pure Land Buddhism have you read? How many are there in English? A handful. Compared to Zen and Tibetan and Theravada books, very, very small. And the reason is because we're kind of scared of it. It looks too much like religion for us modern, sophisticated, secular-type Buddhists that we are. Ooh, too much faith. And Amitabha in his Sukhavati looks a bit like God in heaven to me. No, I don't want anything to do with it. And we've cut ourselves off from this tremendous imaginative way of conceiving of the spiritual life, which is a great pity, I think. So what I'm hoping is that people buy the book. It's not about Pure Land Buddhism. It's about these three texts. It's my commentary on the three texts. And they've been translated afresh, new translations, by another member of the order, Shudapa. Beautiful translations. So, yeah. Thank you for listening.